prayer in this life may seem sometimes to bring little result, but its effect in the Bardo are unprecedentedly powerful. Yet this description of the Bardo shows the sheer difficulty of focusing the mind at this juncture, if we have had no previous training. Think how almost impossible it is to remember something like a prayer in a dream or nightmare. How impotent and powerless we feel in them. In the Bardo of Becoming, it is just as hard, if not harder, to collect our thoughts at all. This is why the watchword of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, repeated over and over again, is "Do not be distracted." In the Bardo of Becoming, as the time for rebirth gets closer, you crave more and more for the support of a material body, and you search for anyone that might be available in which to be reborn. Different signs will begin to appear, warning you of the realm in which you are likely to take rebirth. Lights of various colors shine from the six realms of existence, and you will feel drawn toward one or another, depending on the negative emotion that is predominant in your mind. Once you have been drawn into one of these lights, it is very difficult to turn back. Then images and visions will arise, linked to the different realms. As you become more familiar with the teachings, you will become more alert to what they really mean. You will have an intense desire and longing for certain realms, and you are drawn toward them all too instinctively. The teachings warn us that at this point there is a great danger that out of your avid eagerness to be reborn, you will rush to any place at all that seems to offer some security. If your desire is frustrated, the anger that arises will of itself bring the Bardo abruptly to an end, as you are swept into your next rebirth by the current of that negative emotion. And so, as you can see, your future rebirth is directly determined by desire, anger, and ignorance. You must take great care not to enter blindly into one of these undesirable realms. Yet what is wonderful is that the instant you become aware of what is happening to you, you can actually begin to influence and change your destiny. Swept along by the wind of karma, you will then arrive at a place where your future parents are making love. Seeing them, you become emotionally drawn in, and because of past karmic connections, you begin spontaneously to feel strong attachment or aversion. Attraction and desire for the mother and aversion or jealousy for the father will result in your being born as a male child, and the reverse, a female. But if you succumb to such strong passions, not only will you be reborn, but that very emotion may draw you into birth in a lower realm. Is there anything now that we can do to avoid being reborn, or to direct our next rebirth? The Bardo teachings give two specific kinds of instructions: methods for preventing a rebirth, or failing that, for choosing a good birth. First are the guidelines for closing the entrance to another birth. The best method is to abandon the emotions such as desire, anger, or jealousy, and recognize that none of these Bardo experiences have any ultimate reality. If you can realize this, and then rest the mind in its true empty nature, this in itself will prevent rebirth. The next best method to prevent rebirth is to see your potential parents as the Buddha, or your master, or as a deity. And at the very least, you should try to generate a feeling of renunciation against being drawn into feelings of desire, and to think of the pure realms of the Buddhas. This will prevent rebirth and may cause you to be reborn in one of the Buddha realms. If you must take rebirth, or you intentionally wish to be reborn in order to pursue your spiritual path and be of benefit to others, you should not enter any but the human realm. It is only there that conditions are favorable for spiritual progress. Otherwise, generally, we have no choice. We are drawn toward our birthplace as inexorably as a bird lured into a cage, dry grass catching fire, or an animal sinking into a marsh. Yet as the teachings are always so inspiringly reminding us, there is always hope. Now is the time for prayer. By wishing and concentrating intensely, even at this moment, you can still be reborn in one of the Buddha realms, or else you can generate a deep aspiration to be reborn in a human family, where you may be able to meet the spiritual path and continue toward liberation. If you have a strong karma that impels you toward a particular realm, you may have no choice. However, your past aspiration and prayers can help you to reshape your destiny, so you may be reborn into a life that will lead one day to liberation. Even as you enter the womb, you can go on praying for this to happen. Even now, you can visualize yourself as any enlightened being. Traditionally, the masters say, as Vajrasattva, bless the womb you are entering as a sacred environment, a palace of the gods, and continue to practice. Ultimately, it is the mind's urge to inhabit a particular realm that impels us toward reincarnation, and its tendency to solidify and to grasp that finds its ultimate expression in physical rebirth. This is the next stage in the process of manifestation that we have seen taking place throughout the Bardos. If you succeed in directing the mind toward a human birth, you have come full circle. You are poised to be born again into the natural Bardo of this life. When you see your father and mother in intercourse, your mind is ineluctably drawn in and enters the womb. This signals the end of the Bardo of becoming, as your mind rapidly re-experiences yet again the signs of the phases of dissolution and the dawning of the ground luminosity. Then the black experience of full attainment arises again, and at the same moment, the connection to the new womb is made. So life begins, as it ends, with the ground luminosity.
So often in the modern world, when someone dies, one of the deepest sources of anguish for those left behind to mourn is their conviction that there is nothing that they can now do to help their loved one who has gone, a conviction that only aggravates and darkens the loneliness of their grief. But this is not true. There are many, many ways we can help the dead, and so help ourselves to survive their absence. The Bardo of becoming, as it has already been described, may seem a very disturbed and disturbing time, yet there is great hope in it. The qualities of the mental body during the Bardo of becoming that make it so vulnerable, its clarity, mobility, sensitivity and clairvoyance, also make it particularly receptive to help from the living. The fact that it has no physical form or basis makes it very easy to guide. The most powerful time to do spiritual practice for someone who has died is during the 49 days of the Bardo of becoming, placing special emphasis on the first 21 days. It is during these first 3 weeks that the dead have a stronger link with this life, which makes them more accessible to our help. So it is then that spiritual practice has a far greater possibility of influencing their future and of affecting their chances for liberation, or at least for a better rebirth. We should employ every means possible to help them then, as after the physical form of their next existence begins gradually to be determined, and this is said to happen between the 21st and the 49th day after death, the chance for real change is very much more limited. Help for the dead, however, is not confined to the 49 days after death. It is never too late to help someone who has died, no matter how long ago it was. Dudrum Rinpoche used to say that even if someone has gained enlightenment and become a Buddha, they will still need all the assistance they can possibly get in their work of helping others. The best and easiest way to help a dead person is to do the essential practice of powa as soon as we hear that someone has died. In Tibet, it is said that just as it is the nature of fire to burn and of water to quench thirst, the nature of the Buddhas is to be present as soon as anyone invokes them, so infinite is their compassionate desire to help all sentient beings. Don't for one moment imagine that it would be less effective for you to invoke the truth to help your dead friend than if a holy man prays for them. Because you are close to the person who has died, the intensity of your love and the depth of your connection will give your invocation an added power. The best and most effective time to do the powa is before the body is touched or moved in any way. If this is not possible, then try to do the powa in the place where the person died, or at least picture that place very strongly in your mind. There is a powerful connection between the dead person, the place of death, and also the time of death, especially in the case of a person who has died in a traumatic way. In the Bardo of Becoming, the dead person's consciousness goes through the experience of death every week on exactly the same day. So you should perform the powa, or whatever other spiritual practice you have chosen to do, on any day of the 49-day period, but especially on the same day of the week that the person died. Whenever your dead friend or relative comes to your mind, whenever you hear his or her name being mentioned, send the person your love, and then focus on doing the powa, and do it for as long and as often as you wish. Another thing you can do whenever you think of someone who has died is to say immediately a mantra such as Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of the Buddha of compassion, which purifies each of the negative emotions that are the cause of rebirth. Or Om Amidewa Shri, the mantra of Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of limitless light. You can then follow that again with the practice of powa. But whether you do any of these practices or not to help your loved one who has died, don't ever forget that the consciousness in the Bardo is acutely clairvoyant. Simply directing good thoughts towards them will be most beneficial. When you pray for someone who is close to you, you can, if you wish, extend the embrace of your compassion to include other dead people in your prayers, the victims of atrocities, wars, disasters, and famines, or those who died and are now dying in concentration camps, such as those in China and Tibet. You can even pray for people who died years ago. Imagine your prayers going especially to those who lost their lives in extreme anguish, passion, or anger. Those who have suffered violent or sudden death have a particularly urgent need for help. Victims of murder, suicide, accident, or war can easily be trapped by their suffering, anguish, and fear, or may be imprisoned in the actual experience of death and so be unable to move on through the process of rebirth. When you practice the powa for them, do it more strongly and with more fervor than you have ever done it before. Imagine tremendous rays of light emanating from the Buddhas or divine beings, pouring down all their compassion and blessing. Imagine this light streaming down onto the dead person, purifying them totally and freeing them from the confusion and pain of their death, granting them profound, lasting peace. Imagine then, with all your heart and mind, that the dead person dissolves into light and his or her consciousness, healed now and free of all suffering, soars up to merge indissolubly and forever with the sky-like wisdom mind of the Buddhas. Meditation practices and prayers are not the only kind of help that we can give to the dead. We can offer charity in their name to help the sick and needy. We can give their possessions to the poor. We can contribute on their behalf to humanitarian or spiritual ventures such as hospitals, aid projects, hospices or monasteries. We could also sponsor retreats by good spiritual practitioners or prayer meetings led by great masters in sacred places like Bodh Gaya. We could offer lights for the dead person or sponsor works of art related to spiritual practice. Another method of helping the dead, especially favored in Tibet and the Himalayas, is to save the lives of animals due to be slaughtered and release them again into freedom. It is important to dedicate all the merit and well-being that spring from any such acts of kindness and generosity to the dead person, and in fact to all those who have died, so that everyone who has died may obtain a better rebirth and favorable circumstances in their next life. Remember, the clairvoyant consciousness of the person in the bardo of becoming is 7 times clearer than in life. This can bring them either great suffering or great benefit. So it is essential that after someone you love has died, you are as aware as possible in all your behavior so as not to disturb them or to hurt them. For when the dead person returns to those left behind or those invited to practice on their behalf, they are able in their new state of being not only to see what is going on, but to read minds directly. If relatives are only scheming and quarreling about how to divide up their possessions, only talking and thinking of attachment and aversion with no real love for the dead person, this can cause them intense anger and hurt or disillusion, and they will then be drawn by these turbulent emotions into an unfortunate rebirth. The clairvoyance of the dead person in the bardo of becoming is also what makes the practice done by a master or experienced spiritual practitioner on his or her behalf of such exceptional benefit. What a master does is to rest in the primordial state of Rigpa, the nature of mind, and invoke the mental body of the dead person roaming in the bardo of becoming. When the mental body comes into the master's presence, through the power of meditation, he or she can point out the essential nature of Rigpa. Through the power of its clairvoyance, the bardo being can then see directly into the master's wisdom mind, and so there and then be introduced to the nature of mind and be liberated. Whatever practice an ordinary practitioner can do for a close friend who has died can, for the same reason, be of enormous help. You might simply rest in a steady state of compassion, especially if you then invoke the dead person and invite him or her into the heart core of your practice, it can be of immense benefit. Whenever Buddhist practitioners die, we inform their master, all their spiritual teachers and their spiritual friends so that they can immediately start practicing for them. In Tibet, once the poa practice has been done for the dying person, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is read repeatedly and the practices associated with it are done. In eastern Tibet, there is a tradition of reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead for the whole 49 days after death. Through the reading, the dead are shown what stage of the process of death they are in and given whatever inspiration and guidance they need. This makes it all the more vital that the practitioner should be as focused and attentive as possible when doing the practice, and not merely performing it by rote. Also, as the dead person is living the actual experiences of death, he or she may have a greater capacity to understand the truth of the Tibetan Book of the Dead than we do. Some people ask, But what happens if the consciousness has already fainted into an oblivious state at the moment of death? Since we do not know how long the dead person will remain in that state of unconsciousness, and at what point he or she will enter the Bardo of Becoming, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is read and practiced repeatedly to cover any eventuality. But what about people who are not familiar with the teachings or the Tibetan Book of the Dead? Should we read it to them? The Dalai Lama has given us this clear guidance. Whether you believe in religion or not, it is very important to have a peaceful mind at the time of death. From a Buddhist point of view, whether the person who dies believes in rebirth or not, their rebirth exists. And so a peaceful mind, even if it is neutral, is important at the time of death. If the person is a non-believer, reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead could agitate their mind. It could arouse aversion, and so even harm them instead of helping them. In the case of a person who is open to it, however, the mantras or the names of the Buddhas might help them to generate some kind of connection, and so it could be helpful. It is important to take into account, above all, the attitude of the dying person. One way of comforting the bereaved is to encourage them to do something for their loved ones who have died. By living even more intensely on their behalf after they have gone, by practicing for them, and so giving their death a deeper meaning. A person who is going through bereavement for the first time may simply be shattered by the array of disturbing feelings of intense sadness, anger, denial, withdrawal, and guilt that they suddenly find are playing havoc inside them. Helping those who have just gone through the loss of someone close to them will call for all your patience and sensitivity. You will need to spend time with them and to let them talk, to listen silently without judgment as they recall their most private memories, or go over again and again the details of the death. Above all, you will simply need to be there with them as they experience what is probably the fiercest sadness and pain of their entire lives. Make sure you make yourself available to them at all times, even when they don't seem to need it. Following is a practice that can truly help you when you are suffering from deep sorrow and grief. Many masters say that the practice of Padmasambhava is the most useful when you go through turmoil because it has the power you need to take on and survive the chaotic confusion of this age. So whenever you are desperate, anguished, or depressed, whenever you feel you cannot go on or you feel your heart is breaking, try to do this practice. The only conditions to the effectiveness of this practice are that you need to do it with all your might and that you need to ask, really to ask for help. Even if you practice meditation, you will have emotional pain and suffering, and a lot of things from your past lives or this one may emerge that will be difficult to face. What you need then is what is called a heart practice. The first stage of the heart practice is invocation. Invoke in the sky in front of you the presence of whichever enlightened being inspires you the most, and consider that this being is the embodiment of all the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Masters. For me, as I have said, this embodiment is Padmasambhava. Even if you cannot imagine in your mind's eye any one form, just feel the presence strongly and invoke his or her infinite power, compassion, and blessing. The second stage is calling out. Open your heart and invoke him or her with the presence of all the pain and suffering that you feel. If you feel like crying, don't hold back. let your tears flow and really ask for help. Know that there is someone who is absolutely there for you, someone who listens to you, who understands you with love and compassion without ever judging you, an ultimate friend. Call to him or her from the depths of your pain using the mantra, Om Ahom Benza Guru Padma Siddhi Hum, the mantra that has been used for centuries by hundreds of thousands of beings as a healing spring of purification and protection. The third stage is filling the heart with bliss. Imagine and know now that the Buddha you are crying out to responds with all his or her love, compassion, wisdom, and power. Tremendous rays of light stream out toward you from him or her. Imagine that light as nectar, filling up your heart completely and transforming all your suffering into bliss. One way in which Padmasambhava appears is simply sitting in meditation posture, wrapped in his gown and robes, exuding an enchanting feeling of warm and cozy comfort, and with a loving smile on his face. In this emanation he is called Great Bliss. His hands lie relaxed in his lap, cradling a cup made from the top of a skull. It is full of the nectar of great bliss, swirling and sparkling, the source of all healing. He sits serenely on a lotus blossom, ringed by a shimmering sphere of light. Think of him as infinitely warm and loving, a sun of bliss, comfort, peace, and healing. Open your heart, let out all your suffering, cry out for help, and say his mantra, Om Ahom Benza Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Imagine now thousands of rays of light streaming out of his body or from his heart. Imagine that the nectar of great bliss in the skull cup in his hands overflows with joy and pours down over you in a continuous stream of soothing, golden, liquid light. It flows into your heart, filling it and transforming your suffering into bliss. Lastly, you can do this practice to help someone who has died. As you do this practice again and again, saying the mantra and filling your heart with bliss, slowly your suffering will dissolve in the confident peace of the nature of your mind. You will realize with joy and delight that the Buddhas are not outside of you, but always with you, inseparable from the nature of your mind. And what they have done through their blessing is to empower and nourish you with the confidence of the Buddha within you. Now, with all the power and confidence this practice has given you, imagine you are sending this blessing, the light of healing compassion of the enlightened beings, to your loved one who has died. This is especially vital in the case of someone who has suffered a traumatic death, as it transforms their suffering and brings them peace and bliss. In the past, you may have felt helpless in your grief and impotent to help your dear friend, but now, through this practice, you can feel consoled, encouraged, and empowered to help the dead person. Don't expect immediate results or a miracle. It may only be after a while, or even much later, when you least expect it, that your suffering will shift. Sogyal Rinpoche's heartfelt advice to those in the depths of grief and despair after losing someone they dearly loved is to pray for help and strength and grace. Pray you will survive and discover the richest possible meaning in the new life you find yourself in. Be vulnerable and receptive. Be courageous. And be patient. Above all, look into your life to find ways of sharing your love more deeply with others now. 40 years after the Chinese occupation of Tibet, the world is still ignorant of what has happened, ignorant of the extent of the terror, destruction, and systematic genocide that the Tibetan people have endured and are still enduring. Over 1 million people out of a population of 6 million have died at the hands of the Chinese. Tibet's vast forests, as indispensable as those of the Amazon to the ecology of the world, have been cut down. Its wildlife has been almost totally massacred. Its plateaus and rivers have been polluted with nuclear waste. The vast majority of its 6,500 monasteries lie gutted or destroyed. The Tibetan people face extinction, and the glory of their own culture in their homeland has been almost entirely obliterated. From the very beginning of the Chinese occupation of Tibet in the 1950s, many terrible atrocities were committed. Spiritual masters, monks and nuns, were the first targets, because the Chinese communists wanted above all to break the spirit of the people by wiping out all traces of religious life. Many, many stories have reached me over the years of extraordinary and moving deaths in the worst possible circumstances that witnessed and paid final tribute to the splendor of the truth the Chinese were desperate to destroy. In the province of Kham, there was an old kempo, or abbot, who had spent many years in retreat in the mountains. The Chinese announced that they were going to punish him, which everyone knew meant torture and death, and sent a detachment of soldiers to his hermitage to arrest him. The kempo was elderly and unable to walk, and the Chinese found him an old and mangy horse for his last journey. They sat him on the horse, tied him to it, and led the horse down the path from his hermitage to the army camp. The kempo began to sing. The Chinese could not understand the words, but the monks who were taken with him said later that he was singing songs of experience, beautiful songs that sprang spontaneously from the depth and joy of his realization. Slowly the party wound its way down the mountain, the soldiers in a stony silence, and many of the monks sobbing. The kempo, however, sang all the way. Not long before the party arrived at the army camp, he stopped singing and closed his eyes, and the group then moved on in silence. As they crossed through the gate into the camp, they found the kempo had passed away. He had quietly left his body. What did he know that made him so serene, even in the face of death? He was unmistakably someone who had achieved the highest realization with all that it can bring, that joy and fearlessness and freedom and understanding that are the goal of the teachings and of human life. Think of the great masters and imagine beings who have their depth of realization as magnificent mountain eagles who soar above both life and death and see them for what they are in all their mysterious, intricate interrelation. To see through the eyes of the mountain eagle the view of realization is to look down on a landscape in which the boundaries that we imagined existed between life and death shade into each other and dissolve. The physicist David Bohm has described reality as being unbroken wholeness in flowing movement. What is seen by the masters, then, seen directly and with total understanding, is that flowing movement and that unbroken wholeness. What we, in our ignorance, call life, and what we, in our ignorance, call death, are merely different aspects of that wholeness and that movement. This is the vast and transforming vision opened up to us by the Bardo teachings and embodied in the lives of the Supreme Masters. The uniqueness and the power of the Bardo teachings is that they reveal to us, by showing with total clarity the actual process of death, the actual process of life as well. Let us look now again at what happens to a person who dies at each of the three crucial stages of death. At the culmination of the process of dying, after the dissolution of the elements, senses, and thought states, the ultimate nature of mind, the ground luminosity, is for a moment laid bare. Then, fleetingly, the radiance of that nature of mind is displayed and shines out in appearances of sound, colours, and light. Next, the dead person's consciousness awakens and enters into the Bardo of becoming. His or her ordinary mind returns and takes on a manifestation, the form of the mental body, subject to the dictates of past karma and habits. These drive the ordinary mind to cling on to the illusory Bardo experiences as something real and solid. So what do the Bardo teachings show us that death is? Nothing less than three phases of a process of gradual manifestation of mind. From out of its very purest state of the essential nature of mind, through light and energy, the radiance of the nature of mind, and into increasing crystallization into a mental form. What unravels with such clarity in the Bardo of Dying, the Bardo of Dharmata, and the Bardo of Becoming, the teachings show us, is a threefold process. First, enfoldment leading to laying bare. Second, spontaneous radiance. And third, crystallization and manifestation. The teachings draw us to go further. What they in fact show us, and I think this is a truly revolutionary insight, one which, when it is understood, changes our view of everything, is that this threefold pattern does not only unfold in the process of dying and death. It is unfolding now, at this moment, at every moment, within our mind, in our thoughts and emotions, and at every single level of our conscious experience. If we really examine every aspect of our life, we will discover how we go through again and again in sleep and dream, in thoughts and emotions, that same process of the Bardos. And the teachings reveal to us that it is precisely this fact that we go through the process of the Bardos again and again in both life and death, and at all different levels of consciousness, that gives us innumerable opportunities, now and also in death, for liberation. The teachings show us that it is the character, form, and uniqueness of the process that offer us either the chance for liberation or the potential for continuing in confusion. For every aspect of the whole process hands us at the same time the chance for liberation or the chance for confusion. The Bardo teachings are opening a door to us, showing us how we can step out of the uncontrolled cycle of death and rebirth, the repetitive treadmill of ignorance, life after life. They are telling us that throughout this process of the Bardos of life and death, whenever we can recognize and maintain a stable awareness of the nature of mind, Rigpa, or even when we can gain some measure of control over our mind, we can walk through that door toward liberation. What the Bardo teachings are also telling us, however, is that what happens in our mind now in life is exactly what will occur in the Bardo states at death, since essentially there is no difference. Life and death are one in unbroken wholeness and flowing movement. Thomas Merton wrote, "What can we gain by sailing to the moon if we are not able to cross the abyss that separates us from ourselves? This is the most important of all voyages of discovery, and without it, all the rest are not only useless, but disastrous." We spend millions of dollars every minute on training people to kill and destroy, and on bombs and planes and missiles. But we spend hardly anything in comparison on teaching human beings the nature of life and death, and helping them, when they come to die, to face and understand what is happening to them. What a terrifying, sad situation this is, and how revealing it is of our ignorance and our lack of true love for ourselves and for each other. We are all potential Buddhas, and we all desire to live in peace and die in peace. When will humanity really understand that and truly create a society that reflects in all its areas and activities that simple, sacred understanding? Without it, what is life worth? And without it, how can we die well? It is crucial now that an enlightened vision of death and dying should be introduced throughout the world at all levels of education. Children should not be protected from death, but introduced while young to the true nature of death and what they can learn from it. Why not introduce this vision in its simplest forms to all age groups? Knowledge about death, about how to help the dying, and about the spiritual nature of death and dying should be made available to all levels of society. It should be taught in depth and with real imagination in schools and colleges and universities of all kinds, and especially and most important, it should be available in teaching hospitals to nurses and doctors who will look after the dying and who have so much responsibility towards them. The teachings of all the mystical paths of the world make it clear that there is within us an enormous reservoir of power, the power of wisdom and compassion, the power of what Christ calls the kingdom of heaven. If we learn how to use it, and this is the goal of the search for enlightenment, it can transform not only ourselves, but the world around us. Masters of all religious traditions on earth now understand that spiritual training is essential not solely for monks and nuns, but for all people, whatever their faith or way of life. The danger we are all in together makes it essential now that we no longer think of spiritual development as a luxury, but as a necessity for survival. Let us dare to imagine now what it would be like to live in a world where a significant number of people took the opportunity offered by the teachings to devote part of their lives to serious spiritual practice, to recognize the nature of their mind, and so to use the opportunity of their deaths to move closer to Buddhahood and to be reborn with one aim, that of serving and benefiting others. To learn how to die is to learn how to live. To learn how to live is to learn how to act not only in this life, but in the lives to come. To transform yourself truly and learn how to be reborn as a transformed being to help others is really to help the world in the most powerful way of all.
The most compassionate insight of my tradition and its noblest contribution to the spiritual wisdom of humanity has been its understanding and repeated enactment of the ideal of the Bodhisattva, the being who takes on the suffering of all sentient beings, who undertakes the journey to liberation, not for his or her own good alone, but to help all others and who eventually, after attaining liberation, does not dissolve into the absolute or flee the agony of samsara, but chooses to return again and again to devote his or her wisdom and compassion to the service of the whole universe. What the world needs more than anything is active servants of peace such as these, clothed, as the great master Longchenpa said, in the armor of perseverance, dedicated to their bodhisattva vision and to the spreading of wisdom into all reaches of our experience. We need bodhisattva lawyers, bodhisattva artists and politicians, bodhisattva doctors and economists, bodhisattva teachers and scientists, bodhisattva technicians and engineers, bodhisattva everywhere, working consciously as channels of compassion and wisdom at every level, in every situation of society, working to transform their minds and actions and those of others, working tirelessly in the certain knowledge of the support of the Buddhas and enlightened beings for the preservation of our world and for a more merciful future. May the vision that so many great masters of all traditions have had of a future world free of cruelty and horror, where humanity can live in the ultimate happiness of the nature of mind, come through all our efforts to be realized. Let us all pray together for that better world, first with Shantideva's prayer and then with St. Francis. This prayer of Shantideva is really the heart of the inspiration of his own Dalai Lama. That is, for as long as space exists and sentient beings endure, may I too remain to dispel the misery of the world. Then this great prayer of St. Francis, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in the giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life.